This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. Published by Amnesty International, the State of the World's Human Rights Report was just released a couple of days ago and is an annual documentation of human rights conditions globally. According to Amnesty, across the world, authorities continue to quote-unquote assault universal freedoms, while things like economic crises, climate change and environmental degradation disproportionately affect already marginalized communities. So these are just some of the findings from the report that documents human rights concerns from 2023 in 155 countries, including right here in Malaysia. So today on the show, I'm joined by Katrina Jerin Marliamau. She's the Executive Director of Amnesty International Malaysia. She's going to give us a rundown of, I guess, Malaysia's report card and also share some actions and steps that the government and others can take to do better for everyone. Katrina, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Thank you so much for having me here. I'm very happy to speak a bit about our report and to get more people interested in what's going on globally and in Malaysia.
Okay, well, thanks so much for joining us. Really, really appreciate this. So the report actually just came out yesterday, not a couple of days ago, just yesterday. It's a huge thing, quite a behemoth, but today we want to focus on Malaysia. But just for folks who aren't familiar with this report, maybe you want to give us a kind of an introduction, what it's all about?
Yes. So every year, Amnesty International publishes the annual report, The State of the World's Human Rights. And there are it covers about 155 countries. So we have Amnesty offices in about 70 countries. And the rest, there might be researchers or people on the ground present where we're doing monitoring and documentation. And it is, as you said, a behemoth. It's a huge report. And there are sort of global themes. There's a regional breakdown. And then for each country, there are it's just less than 1,000 words summary, really, a snapshot of what's going on. And so it's not at the country level, it's not very comprehensive, although I think it's really important that we think about how these little snapshots of issues give a sense of the core issues that are happening, but we're also practicing the interconnectedness of it. So, for example, if we talk about freedom of expression, we're also thinking, okay, maybe we in this particular report, we didn't speak about workers' rights, but when you don't have freedom of expression, how are workers' rights affected? And I say this because I don't want us to leave reading the report thinking that, you know, the other issues that didn't come up are not of significance, but really it's sort of a question of fighting within the form and structure. I also want to, flag some of the global themes that have come up. So that's the other value of this report that I find is that we, together as a team, we're all looking at 155 countries, we're seeing what are the patterns that are emerging from here. Mm. And this year, there are three main themes that have come up. And so one, we are really sounding the alarm bells on what we are seeing is the real destruction and active erosion of international human rights norms and really the international global system, right, which is being broken by both governments and corporate actors. And we see this with the conflicts and the lack of response to it, with the redefining of what refugee protection looks like, with the flagrant sort of like just disregard by for UN standards and decisions that are made, are just some examples. So that's one. I think it's rare that I think we would say something in this level of alarm, but in 1948, sort of the world came together and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was passed. And we said that, you know, never again kind of would we go back to the atrocities of that time. And yet we are in this moment where that is being severely threatened. So it's a very, very alarming time. The second theme that we're seeing is the use of tech and how tech is being wielded to stoke hate and division and discrimination. The manifestations of this, of course, you know, are in from both the most personal aspects of our lives, from surveillance and our privacy being invaded and used against us, but also in the conflicts and genocide. But also it's the year of elections. It's really a landmark year of elections globally, and this really poses a huge threat to that. But thirdly, and I think it's a it's also a moment of light. The other theme that we're seeing is really how global solidarity is manifesting itself, which I think is really quite incredible and beautiful. And so where governments and corporate actors are failing us, people have come out in the millions across the globe saying, this is not the world that we want, and really forcing those in power to listen. We are rejecting. It's, you know, we're not getting there with our solutions yet, but I think in that space of building people power, of exchanging ideas, of naming the violations, it's really quite incredible. So those are the three main themes from the global report. And then in Malaysia, we cover sort of six areas on freedom of expression and migrant refugee rights, death penalty, torture, indigenous rights, and the right to a healthy environment.
Okay, excellent. And I think, you know, what you said was really important that, I mean, yes, there's all these things happening, but also these regressions are not going unseen. Yeah. So people are talking about it, and people are, speaking up and fighting against it as well. So, you know, there's always, I guess, hope, isn't it? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, okay. So the global one, okay, we're going to tackle Malaysia today. So let's, you know, as you've mentioned, you know, it's, I mean, very, very well put together. It's simple and very easy to digest. So I was hoping that we can go through it to kind of let our listeners know about what's happening here in Malaysia, right? So I do know the report highlights the government's failure to fulfill commitments regarding freedom of expression in Malaysia. I think that was quite a big one. Can you explain, you know, maybe what some of the incidences of this that, you know, why it made it to the report, I suppose, right? And elaborate on the specific challenges, you know, the individuals face in exercising this fundamental right here in Malaysia.
Sure. I'm going to just take a step back a little and sort of set the scene for what this right really means, because I think that's really quite important to situate our comment. And then for us to just look at what the government has done and said. So firstly, when we talk about freedom of expression being a fundamental human right, what we're saying is that it belongs to all of us. Mm-hmm. So regardless of our age, our nationality, gender, class, sexuality, all of that. And it is really through this basic right that we seek information, we defend ourselves, we fight for accountability and justice, we be creative, we form relationships, we resolve conflicts, we imagine and sort of create the world that we want, right? And so I want to ground us in that, because although there isn't a hierarchy of rights, mm-hmm. so when you talk about human rights, they all sit in an interconnected web. When our right to expression is threatened, it is a very dangerous thing. And so, you know, at the start, I talked about how if we don't have our right to expression, workers' rights, for example, to claim redress gets threatened. And so in Malaysia, what I want us to consider is kind of how fear and intimidation is fostered because of the repressive laws that exist. Whether they are utilized or not, that they hang over us is a point that we must take seriously. But even more so, of course, when they are weaponized. And so what does that do then to not just the individuals who may be targeted, but the social and environment that we're in, the social and self-censorship that gets festered. And so that's one, the context which I do want us to sit with. And there's loads of resources within Amnesty and elsewhere that really helps us unpack freedom of expression. Secondly, so the government, you know, has made commitments to Malaysians when they were campaigning that they would repeal or reform laws that restrict the right to freedom of expression. Yeah. They have not done so. Thirdly, in 2023, we saw the continued use of repressive laws through the Communications and Multimedia Act, the Sedition Act, the Printing Presses and Publications Act, and also provisions of the Penal Code, you know, relating to, quote unquote, causing disunity or hatred on grounds of religion and public fear of distress, end quote. A couple of examples that we cited. One is the banning of the film Mentega Terbang and the charges that were brought against the film's director and producer. This is a film about a young girl confronting a death, the death of her family member, and thinking about her faith. One can imagine that it's a beautiful opportunity for us to sit with these questions of what being human is, and yet the way that the state has acted is to not just ban, but to use the force of the state to intimidate the director and the producer. We saw in October, Kian Wong, the editor of Rebirth, Reformasi, Resistance and Hope in New Malaysia, a book which was banned in 2020. He was arrested for sedition. He was released after 2 days, but the investigations continued. We saw raids on two bookstores, confiscations of books, book bans, and also, you know, confiscations and ban on rainbow-themed watches. So, you know, these are just some examples that we've documented. And these are not markers of a society where our right to expression is thriving, right?
No.
So, you know, the fact that media houses maybe are not shut down or journalists are not arrested, that cannot be the only way we understand what a threat to right to expression is. And so, as I said, when we foster sort of a climate of censorship, and when these laws are being used to restrict, intimidate, harass, question, investigate, that is also a threat to expression. I want to flag one of the acts, for example, the Printing Presses and Publications Act. This has been criticized for decades now, 4 years it has been used, and it gives so much power to the Minister of Home Affairs to grant and revoke licenses for all print media. What this does is that it gives the government tremendous power over newspapers and other printed media outlets. How can there be a free and open environment for journalists to do their jobs when this threat of the Home Affairs looms over them? And so I think that we are, when we sort of think about visuals of rights violations, sometimes we go to sort of what is the most extreme. But what the report, I think, helps us tease out is all these different incidences. Maybe we weren't the ones who was arrested, but now you can imagine that there's a filmmaker sitting there censoring themselves because they're going to be worried, what happens if I want to explore a topic that is a little bit more complex that may raise, you know, questions and doubts among some people, but I'm not going to do it because I may be investigated. Or you have artists and writers, or even people just who may, you know, you may be working as a teacher or a shopkeeper, and you have questions about your faith or questions about the government. And the censorship that is now sort of being instilled within us is going to prevent us from doing so. And so I think about, you know, when we is freedom of expression sort of absolute? No, there are restrictions when it comes to hate speech. Is there hateful speech in Malaysia? Absolutely. You know, one doesn't have to sort of look very far if you're just looking, for example, at the despicable messaging against migrants and refugees, or like homophobic and sexist and misogynistic comments. None of that is okay, right? But the restrictions to free speech under international law can only be in sort of the most extreme of cases and when hate speech sort of fosters violence. But the norm that the government has set, however, is to begin with censorship. And they define, you know, what is acceptable by really vague standards that really seems to be in line with the needs of those who want to maintain power. And that sits in contradiction to human rights standards. I know we don't go into this in the report just because of space, but I want us to think about, you know, what if we're saying, okay, these restrictive and repressive laws need to go, and they do need to go. We have to repeal CMA 233, the Sedition Act, the Printing Presses and Publications Act. Does that mean that we are without any tools to address the hate speech and social issues that we face? Absolutely not. You know, censorship is not the tool we need. What we need is robust journalistic practices, which means journalists must be able to be free to do their job. We need access to information. This means that, you know, government has to be transparent. They cannot hide behind the Official Secrets Act. There must be a right to information. We need excellent media literacy taught at every level in our schools, including, you know, in curricula and in communities. And we also need spaces for open dialogue and skills for conflict resolution and robust fact-checking practices. And also we need leadership from the highest levels down to combat sort of this discrimination that we see. And so I think that as people in Malaysia, and certainly in this government, we know what the decades of divisive politics and threats to freedom of expression has done to Malaysia. We feel it. We live it. It has divided the country further. And so, you know, why? Why does the Anwar administration want to keep furthering these strategies and using these tactics of repression that has led us to this troubling space?
Okay. And You know, it's interesting when you tend to forget everything that's happened. So it's good that this report is here and it reminds us of, you know, all those instances that you said. And yeah, it's good to think about it. And, just still on freedom of expression, how does Amnesty International Malaysia actually view the use of laws like the Printing Presses and Publications Act to restrict the rights of the LGBTI community? Mm. You know, I mean, are there any advocacy efforts underway? What are your comments on that?
So, as I said, the Printing Presses and Publications Act needs to be abolished, right? So it gives far too much power and discretion to the Minister of Home Affairs. Last year, we saw the fact that officials raided 16 Swatch stores and confiscated rainbow-themed watches. It's so absurd to even say these sentences out loud. But that's the absurdity is also where a lot of violence resides and discrimination resides. And then the Home Minister went on. And so the raids happened in May. In August, the Home Minister then invoked his authority under Section 7 of the Printing Presses and Publications Act to issue a prohibition order against, any LGBT-themed watches, boxes, accessories, and so forth. And Swatch Group has since filed the legal challenge on that raid. I think that we, and so one, I know that these legal challenges, two, that are taken on to the LGBT community has really been leading the charge to defend kind of what collective rights are against, non-discrimination and equality. How do you deal with hate speech in ways that are not censorship? But then three, I was asked by a journalist this week, right, about how the government, whether or not it's politically smart to ask the government to defend LGBTI rights, because it may not be, quote unquote, accepted by many people in Malaysia. I think that it's a question that I think a lot of people have, but for me, that's a question of political strategy and not where people in Malaysia and human rights actors and journalists need to come from. The government has an obligation to protect the basic rights of every person within its border. Whether they like them or not, it's irrelevant. Rights belong to all of us, right? And leadership requires that we make difficult and sometimes really unpopular decisions. We cannot lead from a position of cowardice, and we cannot throw any group under the bus to maintain power. One can imagine that fighting racism can be widely unpopular in some countries if the majority holds racist views. But I think we can all understand that, regardless of where the majority sits, we will not accept racism. And so I think as people in Malaysia, we must be very, very concerned that the leadership of this country can choose to reject the basic rights of any group of people, maybe LGBTI people today, migrants and refugees tomorrow. Once we start allowing the enabling of rights, erosion of rights to happen, it is not just harmful to those individuals being targeted, but as we see now in the global situation that we're facing, where rights are under threat and norms that we've long set are being destroyed, that eventually comes for all of us too.
Okay. Karina, let's just go for a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about some of the other findings from the report. Yeah, I'm speaking today to Katrina Jerine Maliamau. She's the Executive Director of Amnesty Malaysia. We are talking about the State of the World's Human Rights Report, which was just released. It's an annual documentation of human rights conditions globally. We are focusing on Malaysia today. We'll continue our discussion after this quick break. Keep it here on Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the line today is Katrina Jerine Maliamau. She's the Executive Director of Amnesty Malaysia. We are talking about Amnesty International's The State of the World's Human Rights Report, which was just released. That is an annual documentation of human rights conditions globally. It's not been not so many great things happening both here in Malaysia and globally. Katrina is helping to give us, Malaysia's report card. We're also going to talk about actions and steps that the government and others can take to just do better for everyone. So before the break, Katrina, we were talking about freedom of expression. Another thing that the report highlighted or discussed was limitations to the right to peaceful assembly. Yes. Yeah. Maybe you want to cite some examples. I think there was a Women's Day March and all of that. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Yes. So we cited a couple of examples. So the investigations into the organizers and the participants of the Women's March gathering that was held last year, and also two separate Labor Day rallies that were held. And again, sort of, you know, the people, organizers and participants sort of faced scrutiny and investigations by the police, really just for exercising this most fundamental right of assembly and protest. And again, just think about that. It's Women's March. It is that the Women's Day is held every year in March. And it is, it in the scheme of things that are controversial, it is shocking to think that people, especially women, coming together to demand gender justice would be seen as a threat to the country and to our security and to whatever else, you know, is used to possibly try and justify investigations. And then you think about Labor Day. Labor Day, well established, coming up next week.
Yep.
Workers around the world really fighting for workers' rights. It is not, it is something that one would think is controversial only if you sit in a position of power where you don't want workers exercising their rights. Mm-hmm. And the same for women's rights. If you feel threatened by women and workers exercising their rights and demanding justice and demanding that their rights be defended, then I think we need to sit and question, why is that? What is it about the way in which you're exercising power that is being threatened by this? So those were some of the examples. But I think that, again, you know, when we, same with freedom of expression, freedom of assembly has been under threat in Malaysia. And similarly, when I talked about freedom of expression, we cannot just look for the most extreme examples. In Malaysia, we can't just understand freedom of assembly being threatened as not being tear gassed and beaten with batons or hit with water cannons. And, you know, those are definitely threats. Yes. To our right to protest.
Yeah.
And like your listeners, you know, I and many and thousands of us in Malaysia in recent history have experienced that. But threats to our right to assembly are not just the extreme acts of violence, right? Mm-hmm. It's also the summoning and organizers to the police station for questioning. It's opening investigation files and you don't know whether those files are going to be closed or the implications of it. It's creating confusion around whether or not you need a permit to assemble. We don't need a permit. You need to just notify the authorities. And notification is not the same thing as seeking permission. It's surveillance. It's enforcement officials walking around assemblies, whether it's carrying weapons or otherwise. And as we saw, you know, the year before last, where that happened. Now, these are all markers of intimidation. The role of the state, let's be clear, is to create an enabling environment for all our rights, including the right to protest. So in this instance, it's, you know, making sure that there's no congestion of traffic, that nobody's injured, that hospitals are not blocked, that if somebody needs medical assistance, they get it, you know, that harassment isn't happening. That's the role of the state, not to tell us what kind of protest they think is comfortable for them, not to say whether or not we can protest. So last month, there was an article that said that the Home Minister is looking into streamlining the processes under the Peaceful Assembly Act to make it more convenient for organizers. Very good. I'd like the Home Minister to know that civil society actors are well and ready with internationally set standards and practices that are centered on human rights if he needs to refer to them, and we are ready to work with him. And I say that, you know, with all sincerity, because civil society actors, human rights actors have for years and years been trying to push for us to make sure that there is clarity on what the role of the state is, and also to combat that fear, again, that has been so entrenched amongst Malaysians that we don't have a right to protest. Yeah. Because people have seen what has happened, right? And I think this is, you know, I started off by talking about global solidarity as being one of the real moments of light and hope. And the counter to that is that globally, we are seeing how states are cracking down on protests using, you know, force, mass arrests, threats and harassment. And they're doing so because they fear people power. So now more than ever, you know, we have to defend our right to protest. And Malaysia and Amnesty is involved also in a global campaign on protecting protest. And so if you look at Amnesty and some of the materials on that, you'll be able to learn a little bit more about sort of our right to freedom of assembly.
Okay. All right. Like you said, it's enshrined in our rights. So, you know, never be afraid of it, right? Okay. Yeah. Okay. And we've got a lot to cover. So just to move on to the next, I think, area of interest. So refugee and migrant rights. Yeah. So you touched on it a little bit, but what are some of the other concerns surrounding refugees and migrant rights, especially concerns about the conditions in immigration detention centres and also the treatment of vulnerable populations such as children and women?
Yeah, so in February of last year, we learned that in 2022, 150 people, including children, died while under the custody of the Immigration Department. And every year, these harrowing statistics are revealed, yet they are met with inaction. Yeah. And I think let's just sort of sit with that for a second, right? So people are dying, including children, under the care and custody and responsibility of the state. And when they die, that is not met with a transparent investigation. It is not met with a robust mechanism to make sure nobody else under my responsibility and the responsibility of the state is going to be harmed. And it doesn't, you know, whether it's one person, that's shocking enough. 150, all the alarm bells should be clanging. In December last year, we learned that over 12,000 people are being detained in immigration detention centres across Malaysia, including 1,400 children.
Oh my gosh.
Immigration offences are administrative matters, the deprivation of liberty is a very serious thing to impose on anybody. The detention of children under any circumstances is traumatizing, it's harmful, it affects the child for the rest of their lives. You know, last year the government transferred 80 children and their guardians to temporary facilities where they're meant to sort of receive quote-unquote more conducive care. And they, you know, applauded themselves for it. But that has been criticized heavily by human rights groups because it is not a human rights-centered plan. Mm. There isn't a plan for the release of these individuals either into community or if they can safely return. And so what then this is just another form of detention, another form of an indefinite detention, which is a violation under international human rights law. We also saw, you know, this year, well, Human Rights Watch had released their report called We Can't See the Sun, Malaysia's Arbitrary Detention of Migrants and Refugees. And it depicted a really harrowing picture of the abuse and inhumane conditions in immigration detention. But it also wasn't new. You know, over the last few decades, from local to international human rights groups, including Amnesty and Suhakam itself, has talked about the ill treatment of people in detention. Mm. We've talked about the death and the abuse, the poor food, the unsanitary conditions, the lack of healthcare. And so, you know, the response by the state, it's not just like bizarre and perplexing for the Home Minister to say and to act as if this was brand new information. And he was just like, what's the basis for this? If there has been a pattern of human rights actors and migrants and refugees themselves and your own human rights institution telling you what's going on, then it is a failure of your job as the minister, as the government, to not immediately and swiftly have a robust and independent investigation. Denials and a defensive posture is not how we stop human rights violations. Last year, we also learned in January that the government deported the remaining 114 adults and children to Myanmar, where they were at risk of serious human rights violations. And all 114 were part of a legal challenge by Amnesty International Malaysia and Asylum Access Malaysia to prevent deportations to Myanmar when the coup had started. Again, the Malaysian government has a position. They have been outwardly critical on the conditions in Myanmar. We see the devastating human rights crises, the escalating conflict. It is a violation of an international customary norm called the principle of non-refoulement to send people back to a place where they may face a persecution or threats or harm. And, you know, the government will say, well, you know, people consented to go back. keeping people in indefinite detention also increases the risk of non-reform war being violated. You cannot say, do you want to remain caged in this hellhole for years on end, or do you want to be sent back where your life is at risk and pretend that we're giving people a choice? So I think, you know, just around the immigration detention system, where there are raids, where there are the practice of indefinite detention, the deportations, that in itself is, it doesn't, again, just affect the individuals who are being targeted, but it creates this climate of accepted violence against thousands of people in Malaysia, migrant workers, migrants, and refugees, people coming here to sort of to seek asylum. And again, I ask everybody listening to think about how, you know, this then affects the access to other rights. If somebody is so fearful of arrest and detention, you can imagine how that's going to prevent them from seeking healthcare. And in fact, we saw how it affects rights to justice, for example, when the government, there were 117 migrant workers who in Johor marched to try and seek redress. And what happened? They were arrested. Suha Kam themselves came out, you know, being so critical of this. And in their quote, they said the victims must have been in such a dire state to risk arrest and detention to seek some kind of justice and redress. And so, again, this climate that we've created where we have enabled the exploitation of migrants through recruitment, through employment, and also the arm of the state hanging over them to prevent them from seeking escape from the abusive conditions that they're in.
Okay. I mean, it's shocking, isn't it? People trying to lodge complaints, and then, I mean, there were also reports where they were detained. You know, so many of these cases are happening. Mm-hmm. And what you know, access do they have? You know, how can they seek redress at all if they're constantly being victimized? It's horrible.
It is. And I think it goes back to that normalization of, you know, rights only belonging to some people. Yeah. When migrants and refugees have rights, it also comes with unchecked powers of the state. You know, there is no reason why at all one's immigration status should be the first way in which you see whether or not they are deserving of dignity and protection from violence. And yet that has been the norm that has been set. If you don't have a journalistic environment where journalists can actively question and investigate the violations against migrants and refugees, when civil society actors also can't, you know, work in a climate where they are free to sort of raise these concerns or access information, all of this just affects each other, right? And so, yeah, these are just only some examples, but we know it's a systemic issue in Malaysia where migrants and refugees have been subject to just the most horrifying conditions for decades on end.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't help that the xenophobia surrounding them as well, you know, they just
absolutely
doesn't help. Okay. So, I mean, but, you know, has the government been responding to, you know, these sorts of criticisms and all these enforcement actions that have been, yeah, you know, even Suha Kam came out to speak about it, as you said.
I think that there might be comments that I made. I thought that the comments that the Home Minister made on the Human Rights Watch report was just appalling. I think that I will, given how dire the situation is, what we need are not just comments. What we need are real major actions for change. And, you know, migrant and refugee leaders are there ready to define kind of what it means, what needs to be done. And there must be that openness by the state to work very closely with civil society, especially migrant and refugee leaders themselves, to not just get a full and clear picture of what the rights violations are, but what are the solutions? Because it can't be a piecemeal approach, you know. There's no point saying, yes, you know, you migrants have right to justice, when the immigration department then conducts all of these raids, and people, when they're arrested, don't have access to lawyers, and there's no access to information. So it has to be a full picture that we take, and at the center of that has to be a human rights-centered approach. And again, the solutions are there. There are enough standards that the government needs to look to. The question is, will they?
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, that remains to be seen, I guess. Katrina, one more quick break, and we'll come back and talk about some of the other topics mentioned in the Human Rights Report. Yeah, the World Human Rights Report. Speaking today to Katrina Jerine Maliamaun, the Executive Director of Amnesty International Malaysia. We are talking about, as I mentioned, the State of the World Human Rights Report. That is an Amnesty International publication just released, annual documentation of human rights conditions globally. We are focusing on Malaysia today. We'll be back with more after one more quick break. Keep it here on Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me today is Katrina Jerine Maliamaun. She is the Executive Director of Amnesty International Malaysia. We are talking about the State of the World's Human Rights Report, which was just released. It is published by Amnesty International. It is an annual documentation of human rights conditions globally. It's not been great. It's 2023. It's almost going back to what year was it? 1948? The conditions? Yep. Yeah.
Yes.
Just severe regressions. A lot of regressions, but, you know, on the bright side, all of these regressions did not go unseen. And there is, you know, increased efforts to speak up against it and to fight it. And so we're talking about that today. So just again, going back to Malaysia's report. So we spoke about freedom of expression, freedom to assemble. There was some good news in Malaysia last year, right? And that was the abolition of the mandatory death penalty and the introduction of alternative sentencing, right? I mean, so that was a good thing. What further steps do you think are needed to ensure fair and just treatment for individuals facing capital punishment in Malaysia?
Yes, we abolished the mandatory death penalty. That's very good. I think also just in if people again are feeling like hope is hard to hold on to, I think it's been a fight for decades. The fight's not over, but it is really that steady, keep going. And when the moment arises, then you have a win, and that's fantastic. But the death penalty is still very much present in Malaysia. So we take that win and we celebrate it, but we also can't sit in the comfort of that because people are still being sentenced to death. And so then to your question of what else is sort of needed, right, to ensure fair and just treatment, I think firstly, you know, to have that context of what the right to fair trial means and why it's important. So, you know, international standards for fair trial should guarantee that all persons arrested or detained on criminal charges have not just legal counsel, but, you know, competent and effective legal counsel. And critically, from the start of a criminal investigation and as soon as they're deprived of their liberty, so until the end. And not just, you know, when you're in court and then a lawyer gets shoved your file and they have to suddenly defend you, which happens in many places. And this is really important because that really allows defendants to protect their rights, prepare their defense. And it's also a really important safeguard against torture and other ill treatment, you know, so that there aren't like coerced confessions and other self-incriminating statements.
Okay.
So Amnesty, and we've put out a pretty long press release a couple of months ago. It's available on our website, where we monitored 6 months of since the laws came into force. And what we found is that, you know, in reports and media reports relating to 50 people, both Malaysians and foreign nationals, who appeared before the magistrate's court to be charged of capital crimes, of this, 56% were represented, but 40% were unrepresented, despite the fact that there are existing legal aid schemes in Malaysia to support defendants. This is really, really troubling. There cannot be any situation where somebody is facing capital punishment and they don't have a lawyer to defend them. I mean, the right to legal counsel exists in all situations, not in the most extreme, but even more extreme here. So what we need to do, we need to make sure that regardless of one's citizenship or legal status or their gender or socioeconomic background, that everybody in court is represented either by a privately appointed or court-appointed lawyer. The second thing of point of concern that we saw is that in several cases, there was a very limited scope of sentencing mitigation considered by the judiciary, and also that the speed at which the resentencing hearings were conducted by the federal court under its temporary jurisdiction was very worrying. And so mitigation and having a robust sort of mitigating factors for the court to consider is crucial. And you cannot just look at what are the established facts, because there might be issues there, you know, there might be new evidence and so forth. And it again prevents people from really presenting a really robust case for themselves and to really defend themselves. And so what we've been asking from the very start is that there be a full consideration of any mitigating factors, right? That will give the court the decisions, the enough information to make sound decisions. And it's not just right to say, okay, we'll consider, but you have to give people the time, the facilities, the resources to do that research, to do that documentation in order to sort of maybe introduce new evidence of mitigating factors that may predate or follow the conviction. So that's also really important. Right to fair trial, consideration of mitigating factors. I'm just going to say something really quickly on the death penalty also, just to make that point that the moratorium on executions, we are saying that there has to be that commitment for the moratorium on executions to be maintained until the death penalty is fully abolished and under everybody sort of under the sentence of the death penalty is the cases are is reversed. And so we can't sort of leave people in that that limbo. Yeah. And although the government has said that they're going to maintain it, it's a policy position and it can be reversed. And so really having that commitment from the state that we keep that moratorium on executions is going to be critical.
Okay. All right. Just to move on to other things that were highlighted in the report, Katrina, there was also mention of the establishment of the Independent Police Conduct Commission, right? The IPCC, and that's highlighted. Can you discuss the commission's effectiveness in addressing cases of police misconduct and also ensuring accountability?
Yes. So that body to sort of investigate and police misconduct and provide oversight came into force. But, you know, it has been something that civil society actors, victims of police violence and their families have been asking for an independent, robust body that can investigate and take action when police misconduct happens. And this has been the IPCMC was the call. If you note, this is the IPCC. So they dropped the miss and misconduct and they've just named it Conduct Commission. Yeah. And I say that only slightly in jest, because actually I think it speaks to the way in which the government has decided to move on this has not been in line with what is required. And so there was so much criticism of the IPCC because it lacks independence. It is not what we need if we want to effectively address the address state violence committed by the police. It lacks investigative powers and enforcement powers. And so although this has now come into force and although, you know, commissioners are being appointed, we should see, I guess, what happens after this. But the structure upon which it's now been set and sort of, I guess, the values of it, if it's not founded on those principles of independence and accountability and if it's also curtailed and weakened, then I'm not too sure how it's going to be effective, but we'll be monitoring this closely.
Okay. All right. Just one more topic quickly. So this is on Indigenous people's rights, right? And kind of the efforts being made to address concerns raised by communities. So in the report, you know, there was mention of the more Indigenous people regarding land rights and environmental impact assessments. You want to just tell us a little bit about that? Just briefly.
So, you know, Indigenous people's rights in Malaysia have always been under threat in many, many ways and systematically infringed upon. One of the ways is sort of we see, of course, Indigenous rights so closely connected to land rights. Palm oil plantations and logging and the construction of dams really continue to threaten the land and livelihood of Indigenous peoples. And so in April of last year, of 2023, seven members of the Temuk Indigenous people people brought a legal challenge against the government for its approval of the environmental impact assessment report of a proposed palm oil project in Rompin Pahang. And what they're saying is that the government has failed to take into account how the project breaches their right to a clean, safe, and sustainable environment. And I think that with Indigenous rights, the Indigenous peoples worldwide have really led the charge in both on for climate justice, because the connections to land so in deeply intertwined with protection of all our other rights. But also we are seeing how the whether it's the protests that are being shut down of Indigenous peoples, the discrimination and harassment that they face, all of that. I do think that we need to listen a lot closer to Indigenous leaders who are really shaping what it means to take leadership when their community is under such assault continuously for generations, and to still hold that vision for the world that we want in really quite incredible ways.
Okay. All right. So again, I know that's something that, you know, you and other civil society organizations will be, I mean, and including Indigenous communities themselves, will be continuing to fight for. We've just run out of time, Katrina, but I guess, you know, just to kind of conclude, the report is here now, right? So what actually happens next? You know, what role does Amnesty International Malaysia envision for itself and for other CSOs to continue advocating for human rights in Malaysia in the coming year?
So Amnesty's role is to monitor, to document, to conduct research, to advocate, to do human rights education, to try and create more spaces for us to come together, to step into our own power, and so to sort of build that people movement. Well, and you know, that's the different civil society actors will play their role in addressing the immediate needs of individuals, providing legal support. I mean, there's a wonderful community of NGOs who work on freedom of expression that have the Legal Defense Fund. And so individuals who are being threatened or arrested and facing charges on FOE can seek support through that. And so I think I would say that because, yes, there are key roles for NGOs to play, and we will keep doing it. We will keep reminding the government of their obligations. In a time of censorship and a rewriting of history, we will keep recording and documenting our reality so that there is a shared record and testimony of our reality. But also, this report is not just for civil society. It's not just for NGOs. It's not just for government and media. It's for all of us to sit with it, to engage with it, to figure out now, as people in Malaysia, what is my responsibility to not just understand what's going on, but to play a part in shifting it. The world is ours to make. It's also ours to unmake. We need to realize the power that we hold to shape the reality that we want. I'm not saying that it's easy, but I think that if we figure out what resources do we have just as people, you know, you have your intellect, your creativity, you have your community networks that you belong to. What can I do to try and address the violations that I'm seeing? But also, what can I do to imagine collectively the world that I want? So in 1948, when, you know, the world was coming out of this truly harrowing, horrifying experience of the genocide and multiple conflicts, and we've been tested time and time again, people, many, many people have said, yes, this isn't what I want, but the world that I want is going to be this and this and this. I think that's the onus on Malaysians also, to not surrender to the reality around us, to not surrender to people who say it is impossible. Often those who say it is impossible to create a different world say so because they benefit from the status quo. And so step into our own power, practice our imagination, build relationships, and really work to sustain each other's strength through care, through information sharing, through collective learning, and through documentation. And that practice of the world we want is really for us to do.
Karina, thank you so much for joining me today. You know, folks, the report is available at amnesty.org. But, you know, for if anyone's interested to support the work that Amnesty International Malaysia does, Katrina, what's the best way that they can, you know, get in touch or, yeah, or help?
So if you go to amnesty.my, amnesty.my, that's Amnesty International Malaysia's website. You'll find there the report, the Malaysian section. The Malaysian section is also translated into Bahasa Malaysia. There are ways in which to contact us. You can also email amnesty@amnesty.my if you want to be on our mailing list, if you want to stay involved. And, you know, we are people are organizing in all kinds of creative ways, and we're always happy to hear from you. And if we can be of use, if we can sort of direct you to more human rights education resources, very happy to do that.
Okay. And of course, follow you guys on your social media channels. Yeah, I think a lot of updates there.
Yes. Thank you, Juliet, for reminding me of that. We are on Instagram, we're on Twitter, or if we insist, X, and Facebook too.
Okay. All right. So folks, you've heard it from Katrina there. Do find out how you can help. Do go and read that report. It's good, you know, to remind ourselves about what's actually happening and not live in our little cocoon. Again, it's called the State of the World's Human Rights. It's a report, and just head to amnesty.my. Yeah, Katrina, you were saying, and you can find the report there. My thanks again to my guests. I was speaking to Katrina Jerine Maliamau, Executive Director of Amnesty International Malaysia. We were talking about the report, State of the World's Human Rights. If you miss any part of our conversation today, you can always search for the podcast at bfm.my/learn. You can also find it on the BFM app. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.